Chapter 24. Shadows Themselves. Through all my time in Tarbiyan, I continued to learn, though most of the lessons were painful and unpleasant. I learned how to beg. It was a very practical application of acting with a very difficult audience. I did it well, but waterside money was tight, and an empty begging bowl meant a cold, hungry night. Through dangerous trial and error, I discovered the proper way to slit a purse and pick a pocket. I was especially good at the latter. Locks and latches of all kinds soon gave up their secrets to me. My nimble fingers were put to a use my parents or Abinthy never would have guessed. I learned to run from anyone with an unnaturally white smile. Denner resin slowly bleaches your teeth. So if a sweet-eater lives long enough for their teeth to grow fully white, chances are they have already sold everything they have worth selling. Tarbiyan is full of dangerous people, but none as dangerous as a sweet-eater, filled with a desperate craving for more resin. They will kill you for a pair of pennies. I learned how to lash together makeshift shoes out of rags. Real shoes became a thing of dreams for me. The first 2 years it seemed like my feet were always cold, or cut, or both. But by the third year my feet were like old leather, and I could run barefoot for hours over the rough stones of the city and not feel it at all. I learned not to expect help from anyone. In the bad parts of Tarbiyan, a call for help attracts predators like the smell of blood on the wind. I was sleeping on the rooftops, snug tightly into my secret place where three roofs met. I awoke from a deep sleep to the sound of harsh laughter and pounding feet in the alley below me. The slapping footsteps stopped, and more laughter followed the sound of ripping cloth. Slipping to the edge of the roof, I looked down to the alley below. I saw several large boys, almost men. They were dressed as I was, rags and dirt. There may have been 5, maybe 6 of them. They moved in and out of the shadows, like shadows themselves. Their chests heaved from their run, and I could hear their breath from the roof above. The object of the chase was in the middle of the alley, a young boy, 8 years old at the most. One of the older boys was holding him down. The young boy's bare skin shone pale in the moonlight. There was another sound of ripping cloth, and the boy gave a soft cry that ended in a choked sob. The others watched and talked in low, urgent tones with each other, wearing hard, hungry smiles. I'd been chased before at night, several times. I'd been caught, too, months ago. Looking down, I was surprised to find a heavy red roof tile in my hand, ready to throw. Then I paused, looking back to my secret place. I had a rag blanket and a half a loaf of bread there. My rainy day money was hidden here, 8 iron pennies I had hoarded for when my luck turned bad, and most valuable of all, Ben's book. I was safe here. Even if I hit one of them, the rest would be on the roof in 2 minutes, and then even if I got away, I wouldn't have anywhere to go. I set down the tile. I went back to what had become my home, and curled myself into the shelter of the niche underneath the overhanging roof. I twisted my blanket in my hands and clenched my teeth, trying to shut out the low rumble of conversation, punctuated by coarse laughter and quiet, hopeless sobbing from below. Chapter 25. Interlude. Eager for Reasons. Kvothe gestured for Chronicler to set down his pen and stretched, lacing his fingers together above his head.
"It's been a long time since I remember that," he said. "If you are eager to find the reason I became the Kvothe they tell stories about, you could look there, I suppose."
Chronicler's forehead wrinkled.
"What do you mean, exactly?"
Kvothe paused for a long moment, looking down at his hands.
"Do you know how many times I've been beaten over the course of my life?"
Chronicler shook his head. Looking up, Kvothe grinned and tossed his shoulders in a nonchalant shrug.
"Neither do I. You'd think that sort of thing would stick in a person's mind. You'd think I would remember how many bones I've had broken. You'd think I'd remember the stitches and bandages."
He shook his head.
"I don't.
I remember that young boy sobbing in the dark, clear as a bell after all these years.
Chronicler frowned.
You said yourself that there was nothing you could have done.
I could have, Quilf said seriously, and I didn't. I made my choice, and I regret it to this day. Bones mend. Regret stays with you forever.
Quoth pushed himself away from the table. That's enough of Tarbian's darker side, I imagine.
He came to his feet and gave a great stretch, arms over his head.
Why, Reshi?
The words poured out of Bast in a sudden gush.
Why did you stay there when it was so awful?
Quoth nodded to himself, as if he'd been expecting the question.
Where else was there for me to go, Bast? Everyone I knew was dead.
Not everyone, Bast insisted.
There was Abinthy. You could have gone to him.
Hallowfell was hundreds of miles away, Bast, Quoth said wearily as he wandered to the other side of the room and moved behind the bar. Hundreds of miles without my father's maps to guide me. Hundreds of miles without wagons to ride or sleep in. Without help of any sort, or money, or shoes. Not an impossible journey, I suppose, but for a young child, still numb with the shock of losing his parents.
Quoth shook his head.
No. In Tarbian, at least, I could beg or steal. I'd managed to survive in the forest for a summer, barely. But over the winter... He shook his head. I would have starved or frozen to death. Standing at the bar, Quoth filled his mug and began to add pinches of spice from several small containers, then walked toward the great stone fireplace, a thoughtful expression on his face.
You're right, of course. Anywhere would have been better than Tarbian.
He shrugged, facing the fire.
But we are all creatures of habit. It is far too easy to stay in the familiar ruts we dig for ourselves. Perhaps I even viewed it as fair. My punishment for not being there to help when the Chandrian came. My punishment for not dying when I should have, with the rest of my family.
Bast opened his mouth, then closed it, and looked down at the tabletop, frowning.
Quoth looked over his shoulder and gave a gentle smile.
I'm not saying it's rational, Bast. Emotions by their very nature are not reasonable things. I don't feel that way now, but back then I did. I remember.
He turned back to the fire.
Ben's training has given me a memory so clean and sharp, I have to be careful not to cut myself sometimes.
Quoth took a mulling stone from the fire and dropped it into his wooden mug. It sank with a sharp hiss. The smell of searing clove and nutmeg filled the room.
Quoth stirred his cider with a long-handled spoon as he made his way back to the table.
You must also remember that I was not in my right mind. Much of me was still in shock, sleeping, if you will. I needed something, or someone, to wake me up.
He nodded to Chronicler, who casually shook his writing hand to loosen it, then unstoppered his inkwell.
Quoth leaned back in his seat. I needed to be reminded of things I had forgotten. I needed a reason to leave. It was years before I met someone who could do those things.
He smiled at Chronicler.
Before I met Scarpy.
Chapter 26. Lanrei turned.
I had been in Tarbian for years at this point. 3 birthdays had slipped by unnoticed, and I was just past 15. I knew how to survive Waterside. I had become an accomplished beggar and thief. Locks and pockets opened to my touch. I knew which pawn shops bought goods from Uncle, with no questions asked. I was still ragged and frequently hungry, but I was in no real danger of starving. I had been slowly building my rainy day money. Even after a hard winter that had frequently forced me to pay for a warm spot to sleep, my hoard was over 20 iron pennies. It was like a dragon's treasure to me. I had grown comfortable there. But aside from the desire to add to my rainy day money, I had nothing to live for. Nothing driving me. Nothing to look forward to. My days were spent looking for things to steal and ways to entertain myself.
But that had changed a few days earlier in Trappa's basement. I had heard a young girl speaking in an awed voice about a storyteller who spent all his time in a dockside bar called the Half Mast. Apparently, every sixth bell, he told a story. Any story you asked for, he knew. What's more, she said that he had a bet going. If he didn't know your story, he would give you a whole talent. I thought about what the girl had said for the rest of the day. I doubted it was true, but I couldn't help thinking about what I could do with a whole silver talent. I could buy shoes, and maybe a knife, give money to Trappas, and still double my rainy day fund. Even if the girl was lying about the bet, I was still interested. Entertainment was hard to come by on the streets. Occasionally, some ragamuffin troupe would mum a play on a street corner, or I'd hear a fiddler in a pub. But most real entertainment cost money, and my hard-won pennies were too precious to squander. But there was a problem. Dockside wasn't safe for me. I should explain. More than a year before, I had seen Pike walking down the street. It had been the first time I'd seen him since my first day in Tarbian, when he and his friends had jumped me in that alley and destroyed my father's loot. I followed him carefully for the better part of a day, keeping my distance and staying in the shadows. Eventually, he went home to a little box alley dockside where he had his own version of my secret place. His was a nest of broken crates he had cobbled together to keep the weather off. I perched on the roof all night, waiting until he left the next morning. Then I made my way down to his nest of crates and looked around. It was cozy, filled with the accumulated small possessions of several years. He had a bottle of beer, which I drank. There was also half a cheese that I ate and a shirt that I stole, as it was slightly less raggedy than my own. Further searching revealed various odds and ends. A candle, a ball of string, some marbles. Most surprising were several pieces of sailcloth with charcoal drawings of a woman's face. I had to search for nearly 10 minutes until I found what I was really looking for. Hidden away behind everything else was a small wooden box that showed signs of much handling. It held a bundle of dried violets tied with a white ribbon, a toy horse that had lost most of its string mane, and a lock of curling blonde hair. It took me several minutes with flint and steel to get the fire going. The violets were good tinder, and soon greasy clouds of smoke were billowing high into the air. I stood by and watched as everything Pike loved went up in flames. But I stayed too long savoring the moment. Pike and a friend came running down the box alley, drawn by the smoke, and I was trapped. Furious, Pike jumped me. He was taller by 6 inches and outweighed me by 50 pounds. Worse, he had a piece of broken glass wrapped with twine at one end, making a crude knife. He stabbed me once in the thigh right above my knee before I smashed his hand into the cobblestones, shattering the knife. After that, he still gave me a black eye and several broken ribs before I managed to kick him squarely between the legs and get free. As I pelted away, he limped after me, shouting that he would kill me for what I'd done. I believed him. After patching up my leg, I took every bit of rainy day money I had saved and bought 5 pints of dreg, a cheap, foul liquor strong enough to blister the inside of your mouth. Then I limped into Dockside and waited for Pike and his friends to spot me. It didn't take long. I let him and 2 of his friends follow me for 1/2 mile, past Seamling Lane and into Tallows. I kept to the main roads, knowing they wouldn't dare attack me in broad daylight when people were around. But when I darted into a side alley, they hurried to catch up, suspecting I was trying to make a run for it. However, when they turned the corner, no one was there. Pike thought to look up just as I was pouring the bucket of dreg onto him from the edge of the low roof above. It doused him, splashing across his face and chest. He screamed and clutched at his eyes as he went to his knees. Then I struck the phosphorus match I'd stolen and dropped it onto him, watching it sputter and flare as it fell. Full of the pure, hard hatred of a child, I hoped he would burst into a pillar of flame. He didn't, but did catch fire. He screamed again and staggered around while his friends swatted at him, trying to put him out. I left while they were busy. It had been over a year ago, and I hadn't seen Pike since. He hadn't tried to find me, and I stayed well clear of Dockside, sometimes going miles out of my way rather than pass near it. It was a kind of truce. However, I didn't doubt that Pike and his friends remembered what I looked like, and were willing to settle the score if they spotted me. After thinking it over, I decided it was too dangerous. Even the promise of free stories and a chance at a silver talent wasn't worth stirring things up with Pike again. Besides, what story would I ask for? The question rolled around in my head for the next few days. What story would I ask for? I jostled up against a dock worker and was cuffed away before I could get my hand all the way into his pocket. What story? I begged on the street corner opposite the Talon Church. What story? I stole 3 loaves of bread and took 2 of them down to Trappist as a gift. What story? Then, as I lay on the rooftops in my secret place where 3 roofs met, it came to me just as I was about to drift off to sleep. Lanray. Of course. I could ask him for the real story of Lanray. The story my father had been... My heart stuttered in my chest as I suddenly remembered things I had avoided for years. My father idly strumming at his lute, my mother beside him in the wagon singing. Reflexively, I began to draw away from the memories, the way you might pull your hand back from a fire. But I was surprised to find that these memories held only a gentle ache, not the deep pain I expected. Instead, I found a small, budding excitement at the thought of hearing a story my father would have sought out, a story he himself might have told. Still, I knew it to be sheer folly to go running Dockside for the sake of a story. All the hard practicality Tarbian had taught me over the years urged me to stay in my familiar corner of the world, where I was safe. The first thing I saw on entering the half-mast was Scarpy. He was sitting on a tall stool at the bar, an old man with eyes like diamonds and the body of a driftwood scarecrow. He was thin and weathered, with thick white hair on his arms and face and head. The whiteness of it stood out from his deep brown tan, making him seem splashed with wave foam. At his feet were a group of 20 children, some few my age, most younger. They were a strange mix to see, ranging from grubby, shoeless urchins like myself, to reasonably well-dressed, well-scrubbed children who probably had parents and homes. None of them looked familiar to me, but I never knew who might be a friend of Pike's. I found a place near the door with my back to the wall and sank down onto my haunches. Scarpy cleared his throat once or twice in a way that made me thirsty. Then, with ritual significance, he looked mournfully into the clay mug that sat in front of him and carefully turned it upside down on the bar. The children surged forward, pressing coins onto the bar. I did a quick count. 2 iron halfpennies, 9 shims, and a drab. Altogether, just a little over 3 iron pennies in Commonwealth coin. Maybe he was no longer offering the silver talent bet. More likely, the rumor I'd heard was wrong. The old man nodded almost imperceptibly to the bartender.
"Fallows red."
His voice was deep and rough, almost hypnotic. The bald man behind the bar gathered up the coins and deftly poured wine into Scarpy's wide clay cup.
"So, what would everyone like to hear about today?"
Scarpy rumbled, his deep voice rolling out like distant thunder. There was a moment of silence that again struck me as ritualistic, almost reverent. Then a babble burst forth from all the children at once.
"I want a fairy story! Orin and the fight at Manat! Yes, Orin Velsitor! The one with Baron! Lartem! Mir Tirinial! Ilion and the Bear! Lanray!"
I said, almost without meaning to. The room went still again as Scarpy took a drink. The children watched him with a familiar intensity I couldn't quite identify. Scarpy sat calmly in the middle of the quiet.
"Did I?"
His voice rolled out slowly, like dark honey.
Hear someone say, Lanrei?
He looked directly at me, his blue eyes clear and sharp. I nodded, not knowing what to expect.
I want to hear about the drylands over the Stormwall,
one of the younger girls complained.
About the sand snakes that come out of the ground like sharks, and the dry men who hide under the dunes and drink your blood instead of water, and...
She was cuffed quickly into silence from a dozen different directions by the children surrounding her. Silence fell sharply as Scarpy took another drink. Watching the children as they watched Scarpy, I realized what they reminded me of. A person anxiously watching a clock. I guessed that when the old man's drink was gone, the story he told would be over as well. Scarpy took another drink, no more than a sip this time. Then he set his cup down and pivoted on his stool to face us.
Who would like to hear the story of a man who lost his eye and gained a better sight?
Something about the tone of his voice or the reaction of the other children told me this was a purely rhetorical question.
So, Lanrei and the Creation War, an old, old story.
His eyes swept over the children.
Sit and listen, for I will speak of the Shining City as it once was, years and miles away.
Once years and miles away, there was Mir Tirinnil, the Shining City. It sat among the tall mountains of the world like a gem on the crown of a king. Imagine a city as large as Tarbian, but on every corner of every street there was a bright fountain, or a green tree growing, or a statue so beautiful it would make a proud man cry to look at it. The buildings were tall and graceful, carved from the mountain itself, carved of a bright white stone that held the sun's light long after evening fell. Selytos was lord over Mir Tirinnil. Just by looking at a thing, Selytos could see its hidden name and understand it. In those days, there were many who could do such things, but Selytos was the most powerful namer of anyone alive in that age. Selytos was well loved by the people he protected. His judgments were strict and fair, and none could sway him through falsehood or dissembling. Such was the power of his sight that he could read the hearts of men like heavy-lettered books. Now in those days, there was a terrible war being fought across a vast empire. The war was called the Creation War, and the empire was called Urgen. And despite the fact that the world has never seen an empire as grand or a war so terrible, both of them only live in stories now. Even history books that mention them as doubtful rumor have long since crumbled into dust. The war had lasted so long that folk could hardly remember a time when the sky wasn't dark with the smoke of burning towns. Once there had been hundreds of proud cities scattered through the empire. Now there were merely ruins littered with the bodies of the dead. Famine and plague were everywhere, and in some places there was such despair that mothers could no longer muster enough hope to give their children names. But 8 cities remained. They were Belen, Antus, Veyret, Tenusa, Emlyn, and the twin cities of Marilla and Morella. Last was Mir Tirinnil, greatest of them all, and the only one unscarred by the long centuries of war. It was protected by the mountains and brave soldiers. But the true cause of Mir Tirinnil's peace was Selytos. Using the power of his sight, he kept watch over the mountain passes leading to his beloved city. His rooms were in the city's highest towers, so he could see any attack long before it came to be a threat. The other 7 cities, lacking Selytos' power, found their safety elsewhere. They put their trust in thick walls, in stone and steel. They put their trust in strength of arm, in valor and bravery and blood. And so they put their trust in Lanrei. Lanre had fought since he could lift a sword, and by the time his voice began to crack, he was the equal of a dozen older men. He married a woman named Lyra, and his love for her was a passion fiercer than fury. Lyra was terrible and wise, and held a power just as great as his. For while Lanre had the strength of his arm and the command of loyal men, Lyra knew the names of things, and the power of her voice could kill a man or still a thunderstorm. As the years passed, Lanre and Lyra fought side by side. They defended Belen from a surprise attack, saving the city from a foe that should have overwhelmed them. They gathered armies and made the cities recognize the need for allegiance. Over the long years, they pressed the Empire's enemies back. People who had grown numb with despair began to feel warm hope kindling inside. They hoped for peace, and they hung those flickering hopes on Lanre. Then came the Black of Drosin Tor. Black meant battle in the language of the time, and at Drosin Tor, there was the largest and most terrible battle of this large and terrible war. They fought unceasing for 3 days in the light of the sun, and for 3 nights unceasing by the light of the moon. Neither side could defeat the other, and both were unwilling to retreat. Of the battle itself, I have only one thing to say. More people died at Drosin Tor than there are living in the world today. Lanre was always where the fight was thickest, where he was needed most. His sword never left his hand or rested in its sheath. At the very end of things, covered in blood amid a field of corpses, Lanre stood alone against a terrible foe. It was a great beast with scales of black iron, whose breath was a darkness that smothered men. Lanre fought the beast and killed it. Lanre brought victory to his side, but he bought it with his life. After the battle was finished and the enemy was set beyond the doors of stone, survivors found Lanre's body, cold and lifeless, near the beast he had slain. Word of Lanre's death spread quickly, covering the field like a blanket of despair. They had won the battle and turned the tide of the war, but each of them felt cold inside. The small flame of hope that each of them cherished began to flicker and fade. Their hopes had hung on Lanre, and Lanre was dead. In the midst of silence, Lyra stood by Lanre's body and spoke his name. Her voice was a commandment. Her voice was steel and stone. Her voice told him to live again, but Lanre lay motionless and dead. In the midst of fear, Lyra knelt by Lanre's body and breathed his name. Her voice was a beckoning. Her voice was love and longing. Her voice called him to live again, but Lanre lay cold and dead. In the midst of despair, Lyra fell across Lanre's body and wept his name. Her voice was a whisper. Her voice was echo and emptiness. Her voice begged him to live again, but Lanre lay breathless and dead. Lanre was dead. Lyra wept brokenly and touched his face with trembling hands. All around, men turned their heads, because the bloody field was less horrible to look upon than Lyra's grief. But Lanre heard her calling. Lanre turned at the sound of her voice and came to her. From beyond the doors of death, Lanre returned. He spoke her name and took Lyra in his arms to comfort her. He opened his eyes and did his best to wipe away her tears with shaking hands, and then he drew a deep and living breath. The survivors of the battle saw Lanre move, and they marveled. The flickering hope for peace each of them had nurtured for so long flared like hot fire inside them. "Lanre and Lyra!" they shouted, their voices like thunder. "Our Lord's love is stronger than death! Our Lady's voice has called him back. Together they have beaten death. Together how can we help but be victorious?" So the war continued, but with Lanre and Lyra fighting side by side, the future seemed less grim. Soon, everyone knew the story of how Lanre had died and how his love and Lyra's power had drawn him back. For the first time in living memory, people could speak openly of peace without being seen as fools or madmen. Years passed. The Empire's enemies grew thin and desperate, and even the most cynical of men could see the end of the war was drawing swiftly near. Then rumors began to spread. Lyra was ill. Lyra had been kidnapped. Lyra had died. Lanrei had fled the Empire. Lanrei had gone mad. Some even said Lanrei had killed himself and gone searching for his wife in the land of the dead. There were stories aplenty, but no one knew the truth of things. In the midst of these rumors, Lanrei arrived at Mir Tirinio. He came alone, wearing his silver sword and haubergeon of black iron scales. His armor fit him closely as a second skin of shadow. He had wrought it from the carcass of the beast he had killed at Drossen Tor. Lanrei asked Seletos to walk with him outside the city. Seletos agreed, hoping to learn the truth of Lanrei's trouble and offer him what comfort a friend can give. They often kept each other's counsel, for they were both lords among their people. Seletos had heard the rumors, and he was worried. He feared for Lyra's health, but more, he feared for Lanrei. Seletos was wise. He understood how grief can twist a heart, how passions drive good men to folly. Together, they walked the mountain paths. Lanrei leading the way, they came to a high place in the mountains where they could look out over the land. The proud towers of Mir Tirinio shone brightly in the last light of the setting sun. After a long time, Seletos said, "I have heard terrible rumors concerning your wife." Lanrei said nothing, and from his silence, Seletos knew that Lyra was dead. After another long pause, Seletos tried again. "Though I do not know the whole of the matter, Mir Tirinio is here for you. I will lend whatever aid a friend can give." "You have given me enough, old friend."
Lanrei turned and placed his hand on Seletos' shoulder.
"Silaneski, I bind you. By the name of Stone, be still as stone. Eru, I command the air. Lay leaden on your tongue. Seletos, I name you. May all your powers fail you but your sight."
Seletos knew that in all the world there were only three people who could match his skill in names: Aleph, Eax, and Lyra. Lanrei had no gift for names. His power lay in the strength of his arm. For him to attempt to bind Seletos by his name would be as fruitless as a boy attacking a soldier with a willow stick. Nevertheless, Lanrei's power lay on him like a great weight, like a vice of iron, and Seletos found himself unable to move or speak. He stood still as stone and could do nothing but marvel. How had Lanrei come by such power? In confusion and despair, Seletos watched night settle in the mountains. With horror, he saw that some of the encroaching blackness was, in fact, a great army moving upon Mir Tirinio. Worse still, no warning bells were ringing. Seletos could only stand and watch as the army crept closer in secret. Mir Tirinio was burned and butchered. The less that is said of it, the better. The white walls were charred black, and the fountains ran with blood. For a night and a day, Seletos stood helpless beside Lanrei and could do nothing more than watch and listen to the screams of the dying, the ring of iron, the crack of breaking stone. When the next day dawned on the blackened towers of the city, Seletos found he could move. He turned to Lanrei, and this time his sight did not fail him. He saw in Lanrei a great darkness and a troubled spirit, but Seletos still felt the fetters of enchantment binding him. Fury and puzzlement warred within him, and he spoke.
"Lanrei, what have you done?"
Lanrei continued to look out over the ruins of Mir Tirinio. His shoulders stooped as though he bore a great weight. There was a weariness in his voice when he spoke. "Was I accounted a good man, Selitos?" "You were counted among the best of us. We considered you beyond reproach. Yet I did this." Selitos could not bring himself to look upon his ruined city. "Yet you did this," he agreed.
"Why?"
Lanray paused. "My wife is dead. Deceit and treachery brought me to it, but her death is on my hands." He swallowed and turned to look out over the land. Selitos followed his eyes. From the vantage high in the mountains, he saw plumes of dark smoke rising from the land below. Selitos knew with certainty and horror that Mir Tirennial was not the only city that had been destroyed. Lanre's allies had brought about the ruin of the last bastions of the Empire. Lanray turned.
"And I counted among the best."
Lanray's face was terrible to look upon. Grief and despair had ravaged it.
"I, considered wise and good, did all this."
He gestured wildly.
"Imagine what unholy things a lesser man must hold within his secret heart."
Lanray faced Mir Tirennial, and a sort of peace came over him. "For them, at least, it is over. They are safe. Safe from the thousand evils of the everyday. Safe from the pains of an unjust fate." Selitos spoke softly. "Safe from the joy and wonder."
"There is no joy!"
Lanray shouted in an awful voice. Stones shattered at the sound, and the sharp edges of echo came back to cut at them.
"Any joy that grows here is quickly choked by weeds. I am not some monster who destroys out of a twisted pleasure. I sow salt because the choice is between weeds and nothing."
Selitos saw nothing but emptiness behind his eyes. Selitos stooped to pick up a jagged shard of mountain glass, pointed at one end.
"Will you kill me with a stone?"
Lanray gave a hollow laugh.
"I wanted you to understand, to know it was not madness that made me do these things."
"You are not mad," Selitos admitted. "I see no madness in you."
"I hoped, perhaps, that you would join me in what I aim to do."
Lanray spoke with a desperate longing in his voice.
"This world is like a friend with a mortal wound. A bitter draught given quickly only eases pain."
"Destroy the world?" Selitos said softly to himself.
"You are not mad, Lanray.
What grips you is something worse than madness. I cannot cure you." He fingered the needle-sharp point of the stone he held.
"Will you kill me to cure me, old friend?"
Lanray laughed again, terrible and wild. Then he looked at Selitos with sudden, desperate hope in his hollow eyes.
"Can you?"
he asked.
"Can you kill me, old friend?"
Selitos, his eyes unveiled, looked at his friend. He saw how Lanray, nearly mad with grief, had sought the power to bring Lyra back to life again. Out of love for Lyra, Lanray had sought knowledge where knowledge is better left alone, and gained it at a terrible price. But even in the fullness of his hard-won power, he could not call Lyra back. Without her, Lanray's life was nothing but a burden, and the power he had taken up lay like a hot knife in his mind. To escape despair and agony, Lanray had killed himself, taking the final refuge of all men, attempting to escape beyond the doors of death. But just as Lyra's love had drawn him back from past the final door before, so this time Lanray's power forced him to return from sweet oblivion. His new-won power burned him back into his body, forcing him to live. Seletos looked at Lanre and understood all. Before the power of his sight, these things hung like dark tapestries in the air about Lanre's shaking form. "I can kill you," Seletos said, then looked away from Lanre's expression, suddenly hopeful. "For an hour, or a day. But you would return, pulled like iron to a lodestone. Your name burns with the power in you. I can no more extinguish it than I could throw a stone and strike down the moon." Lanre's shoulders bowed. "I had hoped," he said simply, "but I knew the truth. I am no longer the Lanre you knew. Mine is a new and terrible name. I am Haliax, and no door can bar my passing. All is lost to me. No Lyra, no sweet escape of sleep, no blissful forgetfulness. Even madness is beyond me. Death itself is an open doorway to my power. There is no escape. I have only the hope of oblivion after everything is gone and the Aelu fall nameless from the sky." And as he said this, Lanre hid his face in his hands, and his body shook with silent, racking sobs. Seletos looked out on the land below and felt a small spark of hope. 6 plumes of smoke rose from the land below. Mir Tirennial was gone, and 6 cities destroyed. But that meant that all was not lost. 1 city still remained. In spite of all that had happened, Seletos looked at Lanre with pity, and when he spoke, it was with sadness in his voice. "Is there nothing, then? No hope?" He lay one hand on Lanre's arm. "There is sweetness in life. Even after all of this, I will help you look for it, if you will try." "No," said Lanre. He stood to his full height, his face regal behind the lines of grief. "There is nothing sweet. I will sow salt, lest the bitter weeds grow." "I am sorry," Seletos said, and stood upright as well. Then Seletos spoke in a great voice. "Never before has my sight been clouded. I failed to see the truth inside your heart." Seletos drew a deep breath. "By my eye, I was deceived. Never again." He raised the stone and drove its needle point into his own eye. His scream echoed among the rocks as he fell to his knees, gasping. "May I never again be so blind!" A great silence descended, and the fetters of enchantment fell away from Seletos. He cast the stone at Lanre's feet and said, "By the power of my own blood, I bind you. By your own name, let you be accursed." Seletos spoke the long name that lay in Lanre's heart, and at the sound of it the sun grew dark and wind tore stones from the mountainside. Then Seletos spoke, "This is my doom upon you. May your face be always held in shadow, black as the toppled towers of my beloved Mir Tirennial. This is my doom upon you. Your own name will be turned against you, that you shall have no peace. This is my doom upon you and all who follow you. May it last until the world ends and the Aelu fall nameless from the sky." Seletos watched as a darkness gathered about Lanre. Soon nothing could be seen of his handsome features, only a vague impression of nose and mouth and eyes. All the rest was shadow, black and seamless. Then Seletos stood and said, "You have beaten me once through guile, but never again. Now I see truer than before, and my power is upon me. I cannot kill you, but I can send you from this place. Begone!
The sight of you is all the fouler, knowing that you once were fair."
But even as he spoke them, the words were bitter in his mouth. Lanray, his face in shadow, darker than a starless night, was blown away like smoke upon the wind. Then Seletos bowed his head and wept hot tears of blood upon the earth. It wasn't until Scarpi stopped speaking that I noticed how lost in the story I had become. He tilted his head back and drained the last of the wine from his wide clay cup. He turned it upside down and set it on the bar with a dull thump of finality. There was a small clamor of questions, comments, pleas, and thanks from the children who had remained still as stones throughout the story. Scarpi made a small gesture to the barkeep, who set out a mug of beer as the children began to trickle out onto the street. I waited until the last of them had left before I approached him. He turned those diamond blue eyes on me, and I stammered. "Thank you. I wanted to thank you. My father would have loved that story. It's the..." I broke off. "I wanted to give you this." I brought out an iron halfpenny. "I didn't know what was going on, so I didn't pay." My voice seemed rusty. This was probably more than I had spoken in a month. He looked closely at me.
"Here are the rules," he said, ticking them off on his gnarled fingers. 1. Don't talk while I'm talking. 2. Give a small coin, if you have it to spare.
He looked at the halfpenny on the bar. Not wanting to admit how much I needed it, I sought for something else to say. "Do you know many stories?" He smiled, and the network of lines that crossed his face turned to make themselves part of that smile.
"I only know one story. But oftentimes small pieces seem to be stories themselves."
He took a drink.
"It's growing all around us. In the manor houses of the Sealdom and in the workshops of the Sealdar, over the storm wall in the great sand sea. In the low stone houses of the Adam, full of silent conversation. And sometimes," he smiled, "sometimes the story is growing in squalid backstreet bars, dockside and Tarbian."
His bright eyes looked deep into me, as if I were a book that he could read. "There's no good story that doesn't touch the truth," I said, repeating something my father used to say, mostly to fill the silence. It felt strange talking to someone again, strange but good. "There's as much truth here as anywhere, I suppose. It's too bad. The world could do with a little less truth and a little more..." I trailed off, not knowing what I wanted more of. I looked down at my hands and found myself wishing they were cleaner. He slid the halfpenny toward me. I picked it up, and he smiled. His rough hand lit lightly as a bird on my shoulder.
"Every day except morning. 6th bell, more or less."
I started to leave, then stopped. "Is it true? The story?" I made an inarticulate gesture. "The part you told today?"
"All stories are true," Scarpi said. "But this one really happened, if that's what you mean."
He took another slow drink, then smiled again, his bright eyes dancing.
"More or less. You have to be a bit of a liar to tell a story the right way. Too much truth confuses the facts. Too much honesty makes you sound insincere."
"My father used to say the same thing." As soon as I mentioned him, a confusing welter of emotions rose up in me. Only when I saw Scarpi's eyes following me did I realize I was backing nervously toward the exit. I stopped and forced myself to turn and walk out the door. "I'll be here, if I can." I heard the smile in his voice behind me.
"I know."
Chapter 27. His Eyes Unveiled.
I left the bar smiling, unmindful of the fact that I was still dockside and in danger. I felt buoyant knowing I would have the chance to hear another story soon. It had been a long time since I had looked forward to anything. I went back to my street corner and proceeded to waste 3 hours begging, not gaining so much as a thin shim for my efforts. Even this failed to dampen my spirits. Tomorrow was morning, but the day after, there would be stories. But as I sat there, I felt a vague unease creep over me. A feeling that I was forgetting something impinged on my too rare happiness. I tried to ignore it, but it stayed with me all day and into the next, like a mosquito I couldn't see, let alone swat. By the end of the day, I was certain I had forgotten something. Something about the story Scarpy had told. It is easy for you to see, no doubt, hearing the story like this, conveniently arranged and narrated. Keep in mind that I had been living like an animal in Tarbian for nearly 3 years. Pieces of my mind were still asleep, and my painful memories had been gathering dust behind the door of forgetfulness. I had grown used to avoiding them, the same way a cripple keeps weight off an injured leg. Luck smiled on me the next day, and I managed to steal a bundle of rags off the back of a wagon and sell them to a ragman for 4 iron pennies. Too hungry to worry about tomorrow, I bought a thick slice of cheese and a warm sausage, then a whole loaf of fresh bread and a warm apple tart. Finally, on a whim, I went to the back door of the nearby inn and spent my final penny on a mug of strong beer. I sat on the steps of a bakery across the street from the inn and watched people coming and going as I enjoyed my best meal in months. Soon, twilight faded into darkness, and my head began to spin pleasantly from the beer. But as the food settled in my belly, the nagging sensation returned, stronger than before. I frowned, irritated that something would spoil an otherwise perfect day. Night deepened until the inn across the street stood in a pool of light. A few women hovered near the doorway to the inn. They murmured in low voices and gave knowing looks to the men who walked past. I drank off the last of the beer and was about to cross the street and return the mug when I saw a flicker of torchlight approaching. Looking down the street, I saw the distinctive gray of a Talon priest and decided to wait until he had passed. Drunk on morning and just recently a thief, I guessed the less contact I had with the clergy, the better off I'd be. He was hooded, and the torch he carried was between us, so I couldn't see his face. He approached the group of nearby women, and there was a low murmur of discussion. I heard the distinctive chink of coins and sunk further into the shadow of the doorway. The Talon turned and headed back the way he had come. I remained still, not wanting to draw his attention, not wanting to have to run for safety while my head was spinning. This time, however, the torch was not between us. When he turned to look in my direction, I could see nothing of his face. Only darkness under the cowl of his hood. Only shadow. He continued on his way, unaware of my presence or uncaring. But I stayed where I was, unable to move. The image of the hooded man, his face hidden in shadow, had thrown open a door in my mind and memories were spilling out. I was remembering a man with empty eyes and a smile from a nightmare. Remembering the blood on his sword. Cinder. His voice like a chill wind. "Is this your parents' fire?" Not him. The man behind him. The quiet one who had sat beside the fire. The man whose face was hidden in shadow. Haliax. This had been the half-remembered thing hovering on the edge of my awareness since I had heard Scarpy's story. I ran to the rooftops and wrapped myself in my rag blanket. Pieces of story and memory slowly fit together. I began to admit impossible truths to myself. The Chandrian were real. Haliax was real. If the story Scarpy had told was true, then Lanre and Haliax were the same person. The Chandrian had killed my parents, my whole troop. Why? Other memories bubbled to the surface of my mind. I saw the man with black eyes, Cinder, kneeling in front of me, his face expressionless, his voice sharp and cold.
"Someone's parents," he had said, "have been singing entirely the wrong sort of songs. They had killed my parents for gathering stories about them. They had killed my whole troop over a song. I sat awake all night with little more than these thoughts running through my head. Slowly I came to realize them as the truth. What did I do then? Did I swear I would find them, kill them all for what they had done? Perhaps. But even if I did, I knew in my heart it was impossible. Tarbian had taught me hard practicality. Kill the Chandrian? Kill Lanre? How could I even begin? I would have more luck trying to steal the moon. At least I knew where to look for the moon at night. But there was one thing I could do. Tomorrow, I would ask Scarpi for the real truth behind the stories. It wasn't much, but it was all I had. Revenge might be beyond me, at least for now, but I still had a hope of knowing the truth. I held tight to that hope through the dark hours of night, until the sun rose and I fell asleep. Chapter 28. Teilu's Watchful Eye. The next day I came blearily awake to the sound of the hour being struck. I counted 4 bells, but didn't know how many I might have slept through. I blinked the sleep from my eyes and tried to gauge the time from the position of the sun. About 6th bell. Scarpi would be starting his story now. I ran through the streets. My bare feet slapped on rough cobbles, splashing through puddles and taking shortcuts through alleyways. Everything became a blur around me as I pulled in great lungfuls of the damp, stagnant city air. I almost burst into the half-mast at a dead run and settled in against the back wall by the door. I dimly realized there were more people in the inn than usual this early in the evening. Then Scarpi's story pulled me in, and I could do nothing but listen to his deep, rolling voice and watch his sparkling eyes.
Selitos One-Eye stood forward and said,
"Lord, if I do this thing, will I be given the power to avenge the loss of the Shining City? Can I confound the plots of Lanre and his Chandrian who killed the innocent and burned my beloved Mir Tirinnil?"
Aleph said,
"No. All personal things must be set aside, and you must punish or reward only what you yourself witness from this day forth."
Selitos bowed his head.
"I am sorry, but my heart says to me I must try to stop these things before they are done, not wait and punish later."
Some of the Ruach murmured agreement with Selitos and went to stand with him, for they remembered Mir Tirinnil and were filled with rage and hurt at Lanre's betrayal. Selitos went to Aleph and knelt before him.
"I must refuse, for I cannot forget, but I will oppose him with these faithful Ruach beside me. I see their hearts are pure. We will be called the Emir in memory of the ruined city. We will confound Lanre and any who follow him. Nothing will prevent us from attaining the greater good."
Most of the Ruach hung back from Selitos, too. They were afraid, and they did not wish to become involved in great matters. But Teilu stood forward, saying,
"I hold justice foremost in my heart. I will leave this world behind that I might better serve it, serving you."
He knelt before Aleph, his head bowed, his hands open at his sides. Others came forward. Tall Kirill, who had been burned but left living in the ash of Mir Tirinnil. Dia, who had lost 2 husbands to the fighting, and whose face and mouth and heart were hard and cold as stone. Enlas, who would not carry a sword or eat the flesh of animals, and who no man had ever known to speak hard words. Fair Giza, who had 100 suitors in Belen before the walls fell. the first woman to know the unasked-for touch of man. La Celta, who laughed easily and often, even when there was woe thick about him. Imet, hardly more than a boy, who never sang and killed swiftly without tears. Ordal, the youngest of them all, who had never seen a thing die, stood bravely before Aelef, her golden hair bright with ribbon. And beside her came Andon, whose face was a mask with burning eyes, whose name meant anger. They came to Aelef, and he touched them. He touched their hands and eyes and hearts. The last time he touched them, there was pain, and wings tore from their backs that they might go where they wished. Wings of fire and shadow, wings of iron and glass, wings of stone and blood. Then Aelef spoke their long names, and they were wreathed in a white fire. The fire danced along their wings, and they became swift. The fire flickered in their eyes, and they saw into the deepest hearts of men. The fire filled their mouths, and they sang songs of power. Then the fire settled on their foreheads like silver stars, and they became at once righteous and wise and terrible to behold. Then the fire consumed them, and they were gone forever from mortal sight. None but the most powerful can see them, and only then with great difficulty and at great peril. They mete out justice to the world, and Teulu is the greatest of them all.
I have heard enough. The speaker wasn't loud, but he may as well have shouted. When Skarpi told a story, any interruption was like chewing a grain of sand in a mouthful of bread. From the back of the room, two men in dark cloaks came toward the bar, one tall and proud, one short and hooded. As they walked, I saw a flash of gray robe beneath their cloaks. Talon priests. Worse, I saw two other men with armor under their cloaks. I hadn't seen it while they were sitting, but now that they were moving, it was painfully obvious they were church strongmen. Their faces were grim, and the lines of their cloaks spoke of swords to me. I wasn't the only one who saw. The children were trickling out the door. The smarter ones tried to appear casual, but some broke into a run before they got outside. Against common sense, three children stayed. There was a Sealdish boy with lace on his shirt, a little girl with bare feet, and myself. I believe we have all heard enough. The taller of the two priests said with quiet severity. He was lean, with sunken eyes that smoldered like half-hidden coals. A carefully trimmed beard the color of soot sharpened the edges of his knife-blade face. He handed his cloak to the shorter, hooded priest. Underneath, he wore the pale gray robe of the Talons. Around his neck was a set of silver scales. My heart sunk deep into the pit of my stomach. Not just a priest, but a justice. I saw the other two children slip out the door. The justice spoke. Under Telu's watchful eye, I charge you with heresy. Witnessed, said the second priest from within his robe. The justice motioned to the mercenaries. Bind him. This the mercenaries did with rough efficiency. Skarpi endured the whole thing placidly, without saying a word. The justice watched his bodyguard begin to tie Scarpy's wrists, then turned his body slightly away as if dismissing the storyteller from his mind. He took a long look around the room, his inspection finally ending with the bald, aproned man behind the bar.
Taylor's blessing be upon you,
the owner of the half-mast stammered explosively.
It is,
the justice said simply. He took another long look around the room. Finally, he turned his head to the second priest, who stood back from the bar.
Anthony, would a fine place such as this be harboring heretics?
Anything is possible, Justice,
"Ah," the justice said softly, and looked slowly around the room, once again ending with an inspection of the man behind the bar.
"Can I offer your honors a drink, if it please you?"
the owner offered quickly. There was only silence.
"I mean, a drink for you and your brothers, a fine barrel of fallow white, to show my thanks. I let him stay because his stories were interesting at first."
He swallowed hard and hurried on.
"But then he started to say wicked things. I was afraid to throw him out because he's obviously mad, and everyone knows God's displeasure falls heavy on those who raise their hands to madmen."
His voice broke, leaving the room suddenly quiet. He swallowed, and I could hear the dry click his throat made from where I stood by the door. "A generous offer," the justice said finally.
"Very generous,"
echoed the shorter priest. "However, strong drink sometimes tempts men to wicked actions."
"Wicked,"
whispered the priest.
"And some of our brothers have taken vows against the temptations of the flesh. I must refuse."
The justice's voice dripped pious regret. I managed to catch Scarpy's eye. He gave me a little half-smile. My stomach churned. The old storyteller didn't seem to have any idea what sort of trouble he was in. But at the same time, deep inside me, something selfish was saying, "If you'd come earlier and found out what you needed to know, it wouldn't be so bad now, would it?" The barman broke the silence.
"Could you take the price of the barrel then, sirs, if not the barrel itself?"
The justice paused, as if thinking.
"For the sake of the children,"
the bald man pleaded,
"I know you will use the money for them."
The justice pursed his lips.
"Very well," he said after a moment. "For the sake of the children."
The shorter priest's voice had an unpleasant edge.
"The children."
The owner managed a weak smile. Scarpy rolled his eyes at me and winked.
"You would think,"
Scarpy's voice rolled out like thick honey,
"fine churchmen such as yourselves could find better things to do than arresting storytellers and extorting money from honest men."
The clinking of the barman's coins trailed off, and the room seemed to hold its breath. With a studied casualness, the justice turned his back toward Scarpy and spoke over one shoulder toward the shorter priest.
"Anthony, we seem to have found a courteous heretic. How strange and wonderful. We should sell him to a Rue troop. In a way, he resembles a talking dog."
Scarpy spoke to the man's back.
"It's not as if I expect you to bound off looking for Haliax and the Seven yourself. Small deeds for small men, I always say. I imagine the trouble is in finding the job small enough for men such as yourselves. But you are resourceful. You could pick trash or check brothel beds for lice when you're visiting."
Turning, the justice snatched the clay cup off the bar and dashed it against Scarpy's head, shattering it.
"Do not speak in my presence," he crackled. "You know nothing."
Scarpy shook his head a little, as if to clear it. A trickle of red lined its way down his driftwood face, down into one of his seafoam eyebrows.
"I suppose that could be true. Taylor always said..."
"Do not speak his name!"
the justice screamed, his face a livid red.
"Your mouth dirties it. It is a blasphemy upon your tongue."
"Oh, come now, Airless,"
Scarpy chided, as though talking to a small child.
"Taylu hates you even more than the rest of the world does, which is quite a bit."
The room became unnaturally still. The justice's face grew pale.
"God have mercy on you,"
he said in a cold, trembling voice. Scarpy looked at the justice mutely for a moment. Then he started to laugh. Great, booming, helpless laughter from the bottom of his soul.
The eyes of the justice flickered to one of the men who had tied the storyteller. With no preamble, the grim-faced man struck Scarpy with a tight fist, once in the kidney, once in the back of the neck. Scarpy crumpled to the ground. The room was silent. The sound of his body hitting the wood planking of the floor seemed to fade before the echoes of his laughter did. At a gesture from the justice, one of the guards picked the old man up by the scruff of his neck. He dangled like a rag doll, his feet trailing on the ground. But Scarpy was not unconscious, merely stunned. The storyteller's eyes rolled around to focus on the justice.
"Mercy on my soul?"
He gave a weak croak that might have been a chuckle on a better day.
"You don't know how funny that sounds coming from you."
Scarpy seemed to address the air in front of him.
"You should run, Quoth. There's nothing to be gained by meddling with these sort of men. Head to the rooftops. Stay where they won't see you for a while. I have friends in the church who can help me, but there's nothing you can do here. Go!"
Since he wasn't looking at me when he spoke, there was a moment of confusion. The justice gestured again, and one of the guards struck Scarpy a blow to the back of the head. His eyes rolled back, and his head lolled forward. I slipped out the door onto the street. I took Scarpy's advice and was on a rooftop running before they left the bar. Chapter 29. The Doors of My Mind. Up onto the rooftops and back to my secret place, I wrapped myself in my blanket and cried. I cried as if something inside me had broken and everything was rushing out. When I had worn myself out with sobbing, it was deep into the night. I lay there looking at the sky, weary but unable to sleep. I thought of my parents and of the troop, and was surprised to find the memories less bitter than before. For the first time in years, I used one of the tricks Ben had taught me for calming and sharpening the mind. It was harder than I remembered, but I did it. If you have ever slept the whole night without moving, then awoke in the morning, your body stiff with inaction. If you can remember how that first terrific stretch feels, pleasant and painful, then you may understand how my mind felt after all these years, stretching awake on the rooftops of Tarbian. I spent the rest of that night opening the doors of my mind. Inside, I found things long forgotten. My mother fitting words together for a song, diction for the stage, 3 recipes for tea to calm nerves and promote sleep, finger scales for the lute. My music. Had it really been years since I held a lute? I spent a long time thinking about the Chandrian, about what they had done to my troop, what they had taken from me. I remembered blood and the smell of burning hair and felt a deep, sullen anger burning in my chest. I will admit I thought dark, vengeful thoughts that night. But my years in Tarbian had instilled an iron-hard practicality. I knew revenge was nothing more than a childish fantasy. I was 15. What could I possibly do? I did know one thing. It had come to me as I lay remembering. It was something Haliax had said to Cinder. "Who keeps you safe from the Aemir, the singers, the scythe, from all that would harm you in the world?" The Chandrian had enemies. If I could find them, they would help me. I had no idea who the singers or the scythe were, but everyone knew that the Aemir were church knights, the strong right hand of the Aeturan Empire. Unfortunately, everyone also knew that there had been no Aemir in 300 years. They had been disbanded when the Aeturan Empire collapsed. But Haliax had spoken of them as if they still existed. And Scarpy's story implied that the Aemir had begun with Seletos, not with the Aeturan Empire, as I had always been taught. There was obviously more to the story, more that I needed to know. The more I thought on it, the more questions arose. The Chandrian obviously didn't kill everyone who gathered stories or sang songs about them.
Everyone knew a story or two about them, and every child at one point has sung the silly rhyme about their signs. What made my parents' song so different? I had questions. There was only one place for me to go, of course. I looked over my meager possessions. I had a rag blanket and a burlap sack with some straw that I used for a pillow. I had a pint bottle with a cork in it, half full of clean water. A piece of canvas sailcloth that I weighted down with bricks and used as a windbreak on cold nights. A crude pair of salt dice and a single tatty shoe that was too small for me, but that I hoped to trade for something else. And 27 iron pennies in common coin. My rainy day money. A few days ago it had seemed like a vast treasure trove, but now I knew it would never be enough. As the sun was rising, I removed rhetoric and logic from its hiding place underneath a rafter. I unwrapped the scrap of treated canvas I used to protect it, and was relieved to find it dry and well. I felt the smooth leather in my hands. I held it to my face and smelled the back of Ben's wagon, spice and yeast with the bitter tang of acids and chemical salts mingled in. It was the last tangible piece of my past. I opened it to the first page and read the inscription Ben had made more than 3 years ago.
Quoth, defend yourself well at the university. Make me proud. Remember your father's song. Be wary of folly. Abinthy.
I nodded to myself and turned the page. Chapter 30. The Broken Binding. The sign over the doorpost read, The Broken Binding. I took it to be an auspicious sign and walked in. A man sat behind a desk. I assumed he was the owner. He was tall and reedy with thinning hair. He looked up from a ledger, his expression vaguely irritated. Deciding to keep niceties to a minimum, I walked to his desk and handed him the book. How much would you give me for this? He leafed through it professionally, feeling the paper between his fingers, checking the binding. He shrugged.
Couple of jots.
It's worth more than that, I said indignantly.
It's worth what you can get for it, he said matter-of-factly. I'll give you 1.5.
2 talents, and I have the option to buy it back for a month. He gave a short, barking laugh.
This is not a pawn shop.
He slid the book across the desk toward me with one hand as he picked up his pen with the other. 20 days? He hesitated, then gave the book another cursory once over and brought out his purse. He pulled out 2 heavy silver talents. It was more money than I'd seen in one place for a long, long time. He slid them across the desk. I restrained the desire to snatch them up immediately and said, I'll need a receipt. This time, he gave me such a long, hard look that I began to get a little nervous. It was only then I realized how I must look, covered in a year's worth of alley dirt, trying to get a receipt for a book I'd obviously stolen. Eventually, he gave another bland shrug and scratched out a note on a slip of paper. At the bottom of it, he drew a line and made a motion with his pen. Sign here. I looked at the paper. It read, I, by signing below, hereby attest to the fact that I can neither read nor write. I looked up at the owner. He held a straight face. I dipped the pen and carefully wrote the letters DD, as if they were initials. He fanned the ink dry and slid my receipt across the desk toward me.
What does D stand for? He asked with the barest hint of a smile.
Defeasance, I said. It means to render something null and void, usually a contract. The second D is for decrepitate, which is the act of throwing someone into a fire. He gave me a blank look. Decrepication is the punishment for forgery in Junpui. I think false receipts fall in that category. I made no move to touch the money or the receipt. There was a tense silence. This isn't Junpui, he said,
his face carefully composed. "True enough," I admitted. "You have a keen sense of defalcation. Perhaps I should add a third D." He gave another sharp, barking laugh and smiled. "You've convinced me, young master." He pulled out a fresh slip of paper and set it in front of me. "You write me a receipt, and I will sign it." I took up the pen and wrote, "I, the undersigned, do agree to return the copy of the book Rhetoric and Logic, with the inscription, to Kvothe, to the bearer of this note in exchange for 2 silver pennies, provided he present this receipt before the date." I looked up. "What day is it?" "Shudin, the 35th. I had fallen out of the habit of keeping track of the date. On the streets, one day is largely the same as the next, save that people are a little more drunk on Hepton, a little more generous on mourning. But if it was the 35th, then I only had 5 days to get to the university. I knew from Ben that admissions only lasted until Kendling. If I missed them, I would have to wait 2 months for the next term to start. I filled in the date on the receipt and drew a line for the bookseller to sign. He looked a little bemused as I slid the paper toward him. What's more, he didn't notice that the receipt read pennies instead of talents. Talents were worth significantly more. This meant he had just agreed to give me back the book for less money than he had bought it for. My satisfaction damped itself when it occurred to me how foolish all of this was. Pennies or talents, I wouldn't have enough money to buy the book back in 2 span. If everything went well, I wouldn't even be in Tarbian tomorrow. Despite its uselessness, the receipt helped ease the sting of parting with the last thing I owned from my childhood. I blew on the paper, folded it carefully into a pocket, and collected my 2 silver talents. I was surprised when the man held out his hand to me. He smiled in an apologetic way. "Sorry about the note, but you didn't look like you'd be coming back." He gave a little shrug. "Here." He pressed a copper jot into my hand. I decided that he was not an altogether bad fellow. I smiled back at him, and for a second I almost felt guilty about how I'd written the receipt. I also felt guilty about the 3 pens I'd stolen, but only for a second, and since there was no convenient way to give them back, I stole a bottle of ink before I left. Chapter 31. The Nature of Nobility. The 2 talents had a reassuring weight to them that had nothing to do with how heavy they were. Anyone who has been without money for a long time will know what I'm talking about. My first investment was a good leather purse. I wore it underneath my clothes, tight against my skin. Next was a real breakfast, a plateful of hot eggs and a slice of ham, bread that was fresh and soft, plenty of honey and butter on the side, and a glass of milk not 2 days from the cow. It cost me 5 iron pennies. It may be the best meal I ever ate. It felt strange sitting at a table, eating with a knife and fork. It felt strange being around people. It felt strange having a person bring me food. As I mopped up the remnants of my breakfast with an end of bread, I realized that I had a problem. Even in this slightly grubby inn waterside, I was attracting attention. My shirt was nothing more than an old burlap sack with holes for my arms and head. My pants were made out of canvas and too big by several degrees. They reeked of smoke, grease, and stagnant alley water. I'd been holding them up with a length of rope I had dug out of some trash. I was filthy, barefoot, and I stank. Should I buy clothes or try to find a bath? If I bathed first, I would have to wear my old clothes afterward. However, if I tried to buy clothes looking the way I did now, I might not even be let into the store, and I doubted that anyone would want to measure me for a fit. The innkeep came to take my plate, and I decided on a bath first, mainly because I was sick to death of smelling like a weak dead rat. I smiled up at him. "Where can I find a bath near here?"
"Here, if you have a couple of pennies."
He looked me over.
"Or I'll work you an hour instead, a good hard hour. The hearth could use scrubbing.
I'll need a lot of water and soap.
2 hours, then. I've got dishes, too. Hearth first, then bath, then dishes. Fair?
An hour or so later, my shoulders ached, and the hearth was clean. He showed me to a back room with a large wooden tub and a grate on the floor. There were pegs along the wall for clothes, and a sheet of tin nailed to the wall served as a crude mirror. He brought me a brush, a bucket of steaming water, and a cake of lye soap. I scrubbed until I was sore and pink. The innkeeper brought a second bucket of hot water, then a third. I gave a silent prayer of thanks that I didn't seem to be lousy. I had probably been too filthy for any self-respecting louse to take up residence. As I rinsed myself for the last time, I looked at my discarded clothes. Cleaner than I'd been in years. I didn't want to touch them, let alone wear them. If I tried to wash them, they'd simply fall apart. I dried myself off, and I used the rough brush to pull through the snarls in my hair. It was longer than it had seemed when it was dirty. I wiped the fog from the makeshift mirror and was surprised. I looked old. Older, at any rate. Not only that, I looked like some young noble's son. My face was lean and fair. My hair needed a bit of a trim, but was shoulder-length and straight, as was the current fashion. The only thing missing was a noble's clothes. That gave me an idea. Still naked, I wrapped myself in a towel and left by the back door. I took my purse, but kept it out of sight. It was a little before noon, and people were everywhere. Needless to say, quite a few eyes were turned in my direction. I ignored them at first and set a brisk pace, not trying to hide. I composed my features in an impassive, angry mask without a trace of embarrassment. I stopped by a father and son loading burlap sacks into a cart. The son was about 4 years older than me and a head and shoulders taller.
"Boy!" I snapped. "Where can I buy some clothes around here?"
I looked pointedly at his shirt.
"Decent clothes," I amended.
He looked at me, his expression somewhere between confusion and anger. His father hurriedly took off his hat and stepped in front of his son.
"Your lordship might try Bentley's. It's plain stuff, but it's only a street or two away."
I darkened my expression.
"Is it the only place about?"
He gaped.
"Well, it could. There's one."
I waved him impatiently into silence.
"Where is it? Simply point, since your wits have left you."
He pointed, and I strode off. As I walked, I remembered one of the young page parts I used to play in the troupe. The page's name was Dunsty, an insufferable, petulant little boy with an important father. He was perfect. I gave my head an imperious tilt, set my shoulders a little differently, and made a couple of mental adjustments. I threw open the door and stormed in. There was a man in a leather apron who I can only assume was Bentley. He was 40-ish, thin, and balding. He jumped at the sound of his door banging against the wall. He turned to look at me, his expression incredulous.
"Fetch me a robe, lackwit! I'm sick of being gawked at by you and every other mueller that decided to go marketing today!"
I slouched into a chair and sulked. When he didn't move, I glared at him.
"Did I stutter? Are my needs perhaps inobvious?"
I tugged at the edge of my towel to demonstrate. He stood there, gaping. I lowered my voice menacingly.
"If you don't bring me something to wear," I stood up and shouted, "I'll tear this place apart! I'll ask my father for your stones as a midwinter gift! I'll have his dogs mount your dead corpse! Do you have any idea who I am?"
Bentley scurried away, and I threw myself back into the chair. A customer I hadn't noticed until now made a hurried exit, stopping briefly to curtsy to me before she left. I fought back the urge to laugh. After that, it was surprisingly easy. I kept him running about for half an hour, bringing me one piece of clothing or another. I mocked the material, the cut, and the workmanship of everything he brought out. In short, I was the perfect little brat. In truth,
I couldn't have been more pleased. The clothing was plain, but well made. Indeed, compared to what I had been wearing an hour before, a clean burlap sack would have been a great step up. If you haven't spent much time in court or in large cities, you won't understand why this was so easy for me to accomplish. Let me explain. Noble suns are one of nature's great destructive forces, like floods or tornadoes. When you're struck with one of these catastrophes, the only thing an average man can do is grit his teeth and try to minimize the damage. Bentley knew this. He marked the shirt and pants and helped me out of them. I got back into the robe he had given me, and he began sewing like the devil was breathing down his back. I flounced back into the chair. "You might as well ask. I can tell you're dying of curiosity." He looked up briefly from his stitching.
"Sir?"
"The circumstances surrounding my current state of undress?"
"Ah, yes."
He tied off the thread and began on the pants.
"I will admit to a slight curiosity, no more than proper. I am not one to pry into anyone's business."
"Ah," I nodded, pretending disappointment. "A laudable attitude." There followed a long moment. The only sound was that of thread being drawn through cloth. I fidgeted. Finally, I continued as if he had asked me. "A whore stole my clothes."
"Really, sir?"
"Yes. She tried to get me to trade them for my purse, the bitch." Bentley looked up briefly, genuine curiosity on his face.
"Wasn't your purse with your clothes, sir?"
I looked shocked. "Certainly not! A gentleman's hand is never far away from his purse, so my father says." I waved my purse at him to make my point. I noticed him trying to suppress a laugh, and it made me feel a little better. I'd made the man miserable for almost an hour. The least I could give him was a story to tell his friends. "She told me if I wanted to keep my dignity, then I'd give her my purse and walk home wearing my clothes." I shook my head scornfully. "Wanton," I said to her. "A gentleman's dignity isn't in his clothes. If I handed over my purse simply to save myself an embarrassment, then I would be handing over my dignity." I looked thoughtful for a second, then spoke softly as if thinking aloud. "It only follows that a gentleman's dignity is in his purse, then." I looked at the purse in my hands and gave a long pause. "I think I heard my father say something of the sort the other day." Bentley gave a laugh that he turned into a cough, then stood up and shook out the shirt and pants.
"There you go, sir. Fit you like a glove now."
A hint of a smile played around his lips as he handed them to me. I slid out of the robe and pulled on the pants. "They'll get me home, I suppose. How much for your trouble, Bentley?" I asked. He thought for a second.
$1 and $2.
I began to lace up my shirt and said nothing.
"Sorry, sir," he said quickly. "Forgot who I was dealing with."
He swallowed.
$1 even would do nicely.
Taking out my purse, I put 1 silver talent into his hand and looked him in the eye. "I will be needing some change." His mouth made a thin line, but he nodded and handed me back 2 jots. I tucked the coins away and tied my purse firmly underneath my shirt, then gave him a meaningful look and patted it. I saw the smile tug at his lips again.
"Goodbye, sir."
I picked up my towel, left the store, and started my altogether less conspicuous walk back to the inn where I had found breakfast and a bath.
"What can I get for you, young sir?"
the innkeeper asked as I approached the bar. He smiled and wiped his hands on his apron. "A stack of dirty dishes and a rag." He squinted at me, then smiled and laughed.
"I thought you'd run off naked through the streets."
"Not quite naked." I laid his towel on the bar.
"There was more dirt than boy before, and I would have bet a solid mark your hair was black. You really don't look the same."
He marveled mutely for a second.
"Would you like your old clothes?"
I shook my head. "Throw them away. Actually, burn them, and make sure no one accidentally breathes the smoke." He laughed again.
I did have some other items, though, I reminded him. He nodded and tapped the side of his nose.
Right enough.
Just a second. He turned and disappeared through a doorway behind the bar. I let my attention wander around the room. It seemed different now that I wasn't attracting hostile stares. The fieldstone fireplace with the black kettle simmering. The slightly sour smells of varnished wood and spilled beer. The low rumble of conversation. I've always had a fondness for taverns. It comes from growing up on the road, I think. A tavern is a safe place, a refuge of sorts. I felt very comfortable just then, and it occurred to me that it wouldn't be a bad life, owning a place like this.
Here you go, then.
The innkeeper laid down 3 pens, a jar of ink, and my receipt from the bookstore.
These gave me almost as much of a puzzle as why you had run off without your clothes.
I'm going to the university, I explained. He raised an eyebrow.
A little young, aren't you?
I felt a nervous chill at his words, but shrugged it off. They take all kinds. He nodded politely, as if that explained why I had shown up barefoot and reeking of back alleys. After waiting for a while to see if I'd elaborate, the barman poured himself a drink.
No offense, but you don't exactly look to be the sort who would want to be washing dishes anymore.
I opened my mouth to protest. An iron penny for an hour's work was a bargain I was hesitant to pass up. 2 pennies was the same as a loaf of bread, and I couldn't count all the times I had been hungry in the last year. Then I saw my hands resting on the bar. They were pink and clean. I almost didn't recognize them for my own. I realized then I didn't want to do the dishes. I had more important things to do. I stood back from the bar and got a penny from my purse. "Where's the best place to find a caravan leaving for the north?" I asked.
"Drover's Lot, up hillside. 1/4 mile past the mill on Green Street."
I felt a nervous chill when hillside was mentioned. I ignored it as best I could and nodded. "You have a lovely inn here. I'd count myself lucky to have one as nice when I've grown up." I handed him the penny. He broke into a huge smile and handed back the penny.
"With such nice compliments, you come back any time."
Chapter 32. Coppers, Cobblers, and Crowds. It was about an hour before noon when I stepped out onto the street. The sun was out, and the cobblestones were warm beneath my feet. As the noise of the market rose to an irregular hum around me, I tried to enjoy the pleasant sensation of having a full belly and a clean body. But there was a vague unease in the pit of my stomach, like the feeling you get when someone's staring at the back of your head. It followed me until my instincts got the better of me, and I slipped into a side alley quick as a fish. As I stood pressed against a wall, waiting, the feeling faded. After a few minutes, I began to feel foolish. I trusted my instincts, but they gave false alarms every now and again. I waited a few more minutes just to be sure, then moved back into the street. The feeling of vague unease returned almost immediately. I ignored it while trying to find out where it was coming from. But after 5 minutes, I lost my nerve and turned onto a side street, watching the crowd to see who was following me. No one. It took a nerve-wracking half hour and 2 more alleys before I finally figured out what it was. It felt strange to be walking with the crowd. Over the last couple years, crowds had become a part of the scenery of the city to me. I might use a crowd to hide from a guard or a storekeeper. I might move through a crowd to get where I was going. I might even be going in the same direction as the crowd, but I was never a part of it. I was so used to being ignored, I almost ran from the first merchant who tried to sell me something. Once I knew what was bothering me, the greater part of my unease left. Fear tends to come from ignorance. Once I knew what the problem was, it was just a problem, nothing to fear. As I've mentioned, Tarbian has 2 main sections, hillside and waterside.
Waterside was poor. Hillside was rich. Waterside stank. Hillside was clean. Waterside had thieves. Hillside had bankers. I'm sorry, burglars. I have already told the story of my one ill-auspiced venture, Hillside. So perhaps you will understand why, when the crowd in front of me happened to part for a moment, I saw what I was looking for. A member of the guard. I ducked through the nearest door, my heart pounding. I spent a moment reminding myself that I wasn't the same filthy little urchin who'd been beaten years ago. I was well-dressed and clean. I looked like I belonged here. But old habits die slow deaths. I fought to control a deep red anger, but couldn't tell if I was angry at myself, the guard, or the world in general. Probably a little of each.
"Be right with you,"
came a cheerful voice from a curtained doorway. I looked around the shop. Light from the front window fell across a crowded workbench and dozens of shelved pairs of shoes. I decided I could have picked a worse store to wander into.
"Let me guess,"
came the voice again from the back. A grandfather gray man emerged from behind the curtain carrying a long piece of leather. He was short and stooped, but his face smiled at me through his wrinkles.
"You need shoes,"
he said timidly, as if the joke was a pair of old boots that had worn out long ago but were too comfortable to give up. He looked down at my feet. I looked down, too, in spite of myself. I was barefoot, of course. I hadn't had shoes for so long that I never even thought about them anymore. At least not during the summer. In the winter, I dreamed of shoes. I looked up. The old man's eyes were dancing, as if he couldn't decide whether laughing would cost him his customer or not. "I guess I need shoes," I admitted. He laughed and guided me into a seat, measuring my bare feet with his hands. Thankfully, the streets were dry, so my feet were merely dusty from the cobblestones. If there had been rain, they would have been embarrassingly filthy.
"Let's see what you like, and if I have anything of a size for you. If not, I can make or change a pair to fit you in about an hour or two. So, what would you be wanting shoes for? Walking? Dancing? Riding?"
He leaned back on his stool and grabbed a pair off a shelf behind him. "Walking."
"I thought so."
He deftly rolled a pair of stockings onto my feet, as if all his customers came in barefoot. He tucked my feet into a pair of something black with buckles.
"How's those feel? Put a little weight on to make sure."
"They're tight."
"I thought so. Nothing more annoying than a shoe that pinches."
He stripped me out of them and into another pair, quick as a whip.
"How about these?"
They were a deep purple and made of velvet or felt.
"Not quite what you're looking for. Don't blame you, really. Wear out terrible fast. Nice color, though. Good for chasing the ladies."
He patted a new pair onto my feet.
"How about these?"
They were a simple brown leather, and fit like he'd measured my feet before he'd made them. I pressed my foot to the ground, and it hugged me. I'd forgotten how wonderful a good shoe can feel.
"How much?"
I asked apprehensively. Instead of answering, he stood and started searching the shelves with his eyes.
"You can tell a lot about a person by their feet," he mused. "Some men come in here, smiling and laughing, shoes all clean and brushed, socks all powdered up. But when the shoes are off, their feet smell just fearsome. Those are the people that hide things. They've got bad-smelling secrets, and they try to hide 'em, just like they try to hide their feet."
He turned to look at me.
"It never works, though. Only way to stop your feet from smelling is to let them air out a bit. Could be the same thing with secrets. I don't know about that, though. I just know about shoes."
He began to look through the clutter of his workbench.
"Some of these young men from the court come in, fanning their faces and moaning about the latest tragedy, but their feet are so pink and soft, you know they've never walked anywhere on their own. You know they've never really been hurt."
He finally found what he was looking for, holding up a pair of shoes similar to the pair I wore.
"Here we go. These were my Jacobs when he was your age."
He sat on his stool and unlaced the pair of shoes I was wearing.
"Now you," he continued, "have old soles for a boy so young. Scars, calluses. Feet like these could run barefoot all day on stone and not need shoes. A boy your age only gets these feet one way.
He looked up at me, making it a question. I nodded. He smiled and lay a hand on my shoulder.
How do they feel?
I stood up to test them. If anything, they were more comfortable than the newer pair for being a little broken in.
Now this pair, he waved the shoes he held, are new. They haven't been walked a mile. And for new shoes like these, I charge a talent. Maybe a talent and two.
He pointed at my feet.
Those shoes, on the other hand, are used, and I don't sell used shoes.
He turned his back on me and started to tidy his workbench rather aimlessly, humming to himself. It took me a second to recognize the tune, Leave the Town, Tinker. I knew that he was trying to do me a favor, and a week ago I would have jumped at the opportunity for free shoes. But for some reason, I didn't feel right about it. I quietly gathered up my things and left a pair of copper jots on his stool before I left. Why? Because pride is a strange thing, and because generosity deserves generosity in return. But mostly because it felt like the right thing to do, and that is reason enough.
4 days. 6 days if raining.
Rowant was the third wagoneer I'd asked about going north to Imre, the town nearest the university. He was a thick-bodied, sealedish man with a fierce black beard that hid most of his face. He turned away and barked curses in Siaru at a man loading a wagon with bolts of cloth. When he spoke his native language, he sounded like an angry rock slide. His rough voice lowered to a rumble as he turned back to me.
2 copper jots, not pennies. You can ride in the wagon if there is space. You can sleep underneath at night if you want. You eat in the evening with us. Lunch is just bread. If a wagon gets stuck, you help push.
There was another pause while he shouted at the men. There were 3 wagons being packed with trade goods, while the 4th was achingly familiar, one of the wheeled houses I had spent most of my early life riding. Rowan's wife, Rita, sat in the front of that wagon. Her mien wavered from severe when she watched the men loading the wagons to smiling when she spoke with a girl standing nearby. I assumed the girl was a passenger like myself. She was my age, perhaps a year older, but a year makes a great deal of difference at that time of life. The Tal have a saying about children of our age. The boy grows upward, but the girl grows up. She was dressed practically for traveling, pants and a shirt, and was just young enough for it not to seem improper. Her bearing was such that if she had been a year older, I would have been forced to see her as a lady. As it was, when she spoke with Rita, she moved back and forth between a genteel grace and a childlike exuberance. She had long, dark hair and, simply said, she was beautiful. It had been a long time since I had seen anything beautiful. Rowand followed my gaze and continued.
Everyone helps set camp at night. Everyone takes a turn watching. You fall asleep during your watch, you get left behind. You eat with us, whatever my wife cooks. You complain, you get left behind. You walk too slow, you get left behind. You bother the girl.
He ran a hand through his thick, dark beard.
Bad things happen.
Hoping to turn his thoughts in a different direction, I spoke up. When will the wagons be done loading?
2 hours,
he said with a grim certainty, as if defying the workers to contradict him. One of them stood upright atop a wagon, shading his eyes with a hand. He called out, raising his voice over the sound of horses, wagons, and men that filled the square.
Don't let him scare you off, kid. He's decent enough after all the growling.
Rowan pointed a stern finger, and the man turned back to his work. I hardly needed to be convinced. A man who travels with his wife is usually to be trusted. Besides, the price was fair, and he was leaving today. I took this opportunity to pull a pair of jots from my purse and hold them out to Rowant. He turned to me.
2 hours!
He held up thick fingers to make his point.
You are late! You get left behind!
I nodded solemnly. Reusa tu kialus asaya tua. Thank you for bringing me close to your family.
Rowan's great shaggy eyebrows went up. He recovered quickly and gave a quick nod that was almost a small bow. I looked around the square, trying to get my bearings.
"Someone's full of surprises."
I turned around to see the worker who had shouted to me from the wagon. He held out his hand.
"Derek!"
I shook his hand, feeling awkward. It had been so long since I'd made simple conversation with someone that I felt strange and hesitant.
"Quoth."
Derek put his hand behind him and stretched his back with a grimace. He stood head and shoulders taller than me, 20 or so, tall and blonde.
"You gave Rowan a bit of a turn there. Where'd you learn to speak Siaru?"
"An arcanist taught me a little," I explained. I watched as Rowan went to speak to his wife. The dark-haired girl looked in my direction and smiled. I looked away, not knowing what to make of it. He shrugged.
"I'll leave you to fetch your things, then. Rowan's all growl and not much gruff, but he won't wait once the wagons are packed."
I nodded, even though my things were non-existent. I did have a little shopping to do. They say you can find anything in Tarbian if you have enough money. For the most part, they are right. I made my way down the stairs to Trappist's basement. It felt strange to make the trip wearing shoes. I was used to the cool damp of stone underfoot when I came to pay a visit. As I made my way down the short hallway, a boy in rags emerged from the inner rooms holding a small winter apple. He pulled up short when he saw me, then scowled, his eyes narrow and suspicious. Looking down, he brushed roughly past me. Without even thinking about it, I slapped his hand away from my purse and turned to look at him, too stunned for words. He bolted outside, leaving me confused and disturbed. We never stole from each other here. Out on the streets, it was everyone for themselves. But Trappist's basement was the closest thing to a sanctuary we had, like a church. None of us would risk spoiling that. I took the last few steps into the main room and was relieved to see that everything else seemed normal. Trappist wasn't there, probably off collecting charity to help him care for his children. There were 6 cots, all full, and more children lying on the floor. Several grubby urchins stood around a bushel basket on the table, clutching winter apples. They turned to stare at me, their expressions flinty and spiteful. It dawned on me then. None of them recognized me. Clean and well-dressed, I looked like some regular boy come wandering in. I didn't belong. Just then, Trappist came back, carrying several flat loaves of bread under one arm and a squalling child in the other.
"Ari," he called to one of the boys standing near the bushel basket,
"come help. We've got a new visitor and she needs changing."
The boy hurried over and took the child out of Trappist's arm. He lay the bread on the table next to the bushel basket, and all the children's eyes fixed on him attentively. My stomach went sour. Trappist hadn't even looked at me. What if he didn't recognize me? What if he told me to leave? I didn't know if I could cope with that. I began to edge toward the door. Trappist pointed to the children one at a time.
"Let me see. David, you empty and scrub the drinking barrel. It's getting brackish. When he's done, Nathan can fill it from the pump."
"Can I take twice?" Nathan asked.
"I need some for my brother."
"Your brother can come for his own bread,"
Trappist said gently, then looked more closely at the boy, sensing something.
"Is he hurt?"
Nathan nodded, looking at the floor. Trappist laid a hand on the boy's shoulder.
"Bring him down. We'll see to him." "It's his leg," Nathan blurted, seeming close to tears. "It's all hot, and he can't walk."
Trappist nodded and gestured to the next child.
"Jen, you help Nathan bring his brother back."
They hurried out.
"Tam, since Nathan's gone, you carry the water instead. Quoth, you run for soap."
He held out a halfpenny.
"Go to Marna's in the wash. You'll get better from her if you tell her who it's for."
I felt a sudden lump form in my throat. He knew me. I can't hope to explain to you how much of a relief it was. Trappist was the closest thing I had to a family. The thought of him not knowing me had been horrifying.
I don't have time to run an errand, Trappist, I said hesitantly. I'm leaving. I'm heading inland, to Imre.
Are you, then?
He asked, then paused and gave me a second, closer look.
Well, then, I guess you are.
Of course, Trappist never saw the clothes, only the child inside them. I stopped by to let you know where my things are. On the roof of the candleworks, there's a place where three roofs meet. There are some things there, a blanket, a bottle. I don't need any of it anymore. It's a good place to sleep if anyone needs one. Dry. No one goes there. I trailed off.
That's kind of you. I'll send one of the boys round, Trappist said. Come here.
He came forward and gathered me into a clumsy hug, his beard tickling the side of my face.
I'm always glad to see one of you get away, he said softly to me. I know you'll do just fine for yourself, but you can always come back if you need to.
One of the girls on a nearby cot began to thrash and moan. Trappist pulled away from me and turned to look.
What?
He said as he hurried over to tend her, his bare feet slapping on the floor.
What? Hush, hush.
Chapter 33, A Sea of Stars. I returned to Drover's lot with a travel sack swinging by one shoulder. It held a change of clothes, a loaf of trail bread, some jerked meat, a skin of water, needle and thread, flint and steel, pens and ink. In short, everything an intelligent person takes on a trip in the event they might need it. However, my proudest acquisition was a dark blue cloak that I had bought off a fripperer's cart for only 3 jots. It was warm, clean, and, unless I missed my guess, only one owner from New. Now, let me say this. When you're traveling, a good cloak is worth more than all your other possessions put together. If you've nowhere to sleep, it can be your bed and blanket. It will keep the rain off your back and the sun from your eyes. You can conceal all manner of interesting weaponry beneath it if you are clever, and a smaller assortment if you are not. Beyond all that, 2 facts remain to recommend a cloak. First, very little is as striking as a well-worn cloak billowing lightly about you in the breeze. And second, the best cloaks have innumerable little pockets that I have an irrational and overpowering attraction toward. As I have said, this was a good cloak, and it had a number of such pockets. Squirreled away in them I had string and wax, some dried apple, a tinderbox, a marble in a small leather sack, a pouch of salt, hook, needle, and gut. I'd made a point of spending all my carefully hoarded Commonwealth coin, keeping my hard Sealdish currency for my trip. Pennies spent well enough here in Tarbian, but Sealdish money was solid no matter where in the four corners you found yourself. A final flurry of preparation was being made as I arrived. Rowant paced around the wagons like a restless animal, checking everything again and again. Rita watched the workers with a stern eye and a quick word for anything that wasn't being done to her satisfaction. I was comfortably ignored until we headed out of the city toward the university. As the miles rolled away, it was as if a great weight slowly fell away from me. I reveled in the feel of the ground through my shoes, the taste of the air, the quiet hush of wind brushing through the spring wheat in the fields. I found myself grinning for no good reason, save that I was happy. We Rue are not meant to stay in one place for so long. I took a deep breath and nearly laughed out loud. I kept to myself as we traveled, not being used to the company of others. Rowant and the mercenaries were willing to leave me alone. Derek joked with me off and on, but generally found me too reserved for his tastes. That left the other passenger, Denna. We didn't speak until the first day's ride was nearly done. I was riding with one of the mercenaries, absently peeling the bark from a willow switch. While my fingers worked, I studied the side of her face, admiring the line of her jaw, the curve of her neck into her shoulder. I wondered why she was traveling alone and where she was going. In the middle of my musing, she turned to look in my direction and caught me staring at her.
Penny for your thoughts?
She asked, brushing an errant strand of hair.
I was wondering what you're doing here, I said half honestly.
Smiling, she held my eyes.
Liar.
I used an old stage trick to keep myself from blushing, gave my best unconcerned shrug, and looked down at the willow wand I was peeling. After a few minutes, I heard her return to conversation with Rita. I found myself strangely disappointed. After camp was set and dinner was cooking, I idled around the wagons, examining knots Rowant used to lash his cargo into place. I heard a footfall behind me and turned to see Denna approaching. My stomach rolled over and I took a short breath to compose myself. She stopped about a dozen feet from me.
Have you figured it out yet? She asked.
Excuse me?
Why I'm here, she smiled gently. I've been wondering the same thing for most of my life, you see. I thought if you had any ideas.
She gave me a wry, hopeful look. I shook my head, too uncertain of the situation to find humor in it. All I've been able to guess is that you're going somewhere. She nodded seriously.
That's as much as I've guessed, too.
She paused to look at the circle the horizon made around us. The wind caught her hair, and she brushed it back again.
Do you happen to know where I'm going?
I felt a smile begin a slow creep onto my face.
It felt odd. I was out of practice smiling.
Don't you know?
I have suspicions. Right now I'm thinking Annalyn.
She rocked onto the edges of her feet, then back to the flats.
But I've been wrong before.
A silence settled over our conversation. Denna looked down at her hands, fidgeting with a ring on her finger, twisting it. I caught a glimpse of silver and a pale blue stone. Suddenly, she dropped her hands to her sides and looked up at me.
Where are you going?
The university. She arched an eyebrow, looking 10 years older.
So certain.
She smiled and was suddenly young again.
How does it feel to know where you are going?
I couldn't think of a reply, but was saved from the need for one by Rita calling us for supper. Denna and I walked toward the campfire, together. The beginning of the next day was spent in a brief, awkward courtship. Eager, but not wanting to seem eager, I made a slow dance around Denna before finally finding some excuse to spend time with her. Denna, on the other hand, seemed perfectly at ease. We spent the rest of the day as if we were old friends. We joked and told stories. I pointed out the different types of clouds and what they told of the weather to come. She showed me the shapes they held. A rose, a harp, a waterfall. So passed the day. Later, when lots were being drawn to see who had which turn at watch, Denna and I drew the first two shifts. Without discussing it, we shared the 4 hours of watch together, talking softly so as to not wake the others. We sat close by the fire and spent the time watching very little but each other. The third day was much the same. We passed the time pleasantly, not in long conversation, but more often watching the scenery, saying whatever happened to come to our minds. That night, we stopped at a wayside inn where Rita bought fodder for the horses and a few other supplies. Rita retired early with her husband, telling each of us that she'd arranged for our dinners and beds with the innkeeper. The former was quite good, bacon and potato soup with fresh bread and butter. The latter was in the stables, but it was still a long sight better than what I was used to in Tarbian. The common room smelled of smoke and sweat and spilled beer. I was glad when Denna asked if I wanted to take a walk. Outside was the warm quiet of a windless spring night. We talked as we wended our slow way through the wild bit of forest behind the inn. After a while, we came to a wide clearing circling a pond. On the edge of the water were a pair of waystones, their surfaces silver against the black of the sky, the black of the water. One stood upright, a finger pointing to the sky. The other lay flat, extending into the water like a short stone pier. No breath of wind disturbed the surface of the water, so as we climbed out onto the fallen stone,
the stars reflected themselves in double fashion, as above, so below. It was as if we were sitting amid a sea of stars. We spoke for hours, late into the night. Neither of us mentioned our pasts. I sensed that there were things she would rather not talk about, and by the way she avoided questioning me, I think she guessed the same. We spoke of ourselves instead, of fond imaginings and impossible things. I pointed to the skies and told her the names of stars and constellations. She told me stories about them I had never heard before. My eyes were always returning to Denna. She sat beside me, arms hugging her knees. Her skin was more luminous than the moon, her eyes wider than the sky, deeper than the water, darker than the night. It slowly began to dawn on me that I'd been staring at her wordlessly for an impossible amount of time. Lost in my thoughts, lost in the sight of her. But her face didn't look offended or amused. It almost looked as if she were studying the lines of my face, almost as if she were waiting. I wanted to take her hand. I wanted to brush her cheek with my fingertips. I wanted to tell her that she was the first beautiful thing I had seen in 3 years, that the sight of her yawning to the back of her hand was enough to drive the breath from me, how I sometimes lost the sense of her words in the sweet fluting of her voice. I wanted to say that if she were with me then, somehow nothing could ever be wrong for me again. In that breathless second, I almost asked her. I felt the question boiling up from my chest. I remember drawing a breath, then hesitating. What could I say? Come away with me? Stay with me? Come to the university? No. Sudden certainty tightened in my chest like a cold fist. What could I ask her? What could I offer? Nothing. Anything I said would sound foolish. A child's fantasy. I closed my mouth and looked across the water. Inches away, Denna did the same. I could feel the heat of her. She smelled like road dust and honey, and the smell the air holds seconds before a heavy summer rain. Neither of us spoke. I closed my eyes. The closeness of her was the sweetest, sharpest thing my life had ever known. Chapter 34. Yet to Learn. The next morning, I blearily awoke after 2 hours of sleep, bundled myself onto one of the wagons, and proceeded to drowse away the morning. It was nearly noon before I realized that we had taken on another passenger at the inn last night. His name was Jazen, and he had paid Rowant for passage to Annalyn. He had an easy manner and an honest smile. He seemed an earnest man. I did not like him. My reason was simple. He spent the entire day riding next to Denna. He flattered her outrageously and joked with her about becoming one of his wives. She seemed unaffected by the late hours we had kept the night before, looking as bright and fresh as ever. The result was that I spent the day being irritated and jealous while acting unconcerned. Since I was too proud to join their conversation, I was left to myself. I spent the day thinking sullen thoughts, trying to ignore the sound of his voice and occasionally remembering the way Denna had looked last night with the moon reflecting off the water behind her. That night, I was planning to ask Denna to go for a walk after everyone turned in for the night. But before I could approach her, Jazen went to one of the wagons and brought back a large black case with brass buckles along the side. The sight of it made my heart turn sideways in my chest. Sensing the group's anticipation, though not mine in particular, Jazen slowly undid the brass clasps and drew out his lute with an air of studied nonchalance. It was a trooper's lute. Its long, graceful neck and round bowl were painfully familiar. Sure of everyone's attention, he cocked his head and strummed, pausing to listen to the sound. Then, nodding to himself, he started to play. He had a fair tenor and reasonably clever fingers. He played a ballad, then a light, quick drinking song,
then a slow, sad melody in a language that I didn't recognize, but suspected might be Yiddish. Lastly, he played Tinker Tanner, and everyone came in on the chorus. Everyone but me. I sat still as stone with my fingers aching. I wanted to play, not listen. Want isn't strong enough a word. I was hungry for it. Starved. I'm not proud of the fact that I thought about stealing his lute and leaving in the dark of the night. He finished the song with a flourish, and Rowan clapped his hands a couple of times to get everyone's attention.
Time for sleep! You sleep too late?
Derek broke in, gently teasing.
We get left behind. We know, Master Rowan. We'll be ready to roll with the light.
Jazin laughed and flipped open his lute case with his foot, but before he could put it away, I called over to him. Could I see that for a second? I tried to keep the desperation out of my voice, tried to make it sound like idle curiosity. I hated myself for the question. Asking to hold a musician's instrument is roughly similar to asking to kiss a man's wife. Non-musicians don't understand. An instrument is like a companion and a lover. Strangers ask to touch and hold with annoying regularity. I knew better, but I couldn't help myself. Just for a second. I saw him stiffen slightly, reluctant. But keeping friendly appearances is a minstrel's business, just as much as music.
Certainly,
he said with a jocularity that I saw as false, but was probably convincing for the others. He strode over to me and held it out.
Be careful.
Jazin took a couple of steps back and gave a very good appearance of being at ease, but I saw how he stood with his arms slightly bent, ready to rush forward and whisk the lute away from me if the need arose. I turned it over in my hands. Objectively, it was nothing special. My father would have rated it as one short step above firewood. I touched the wood. I cradled it against my chest. I spoke without looking up.
It's beautiful,
I said softly, my voice rough with emotion. It was beautiful. It was the most beautiful thing I had seen in 3 years. More beautiful than the sight of a spring field after 3 years of living in that pestilent cesspit of a city. More beautiful than Denna. Almost. I can honestly say that I was still not really myself. I was only 4 days away from living on the streets. I was not the same person I had been back in the days of the troop, but neither was I yet the person you hear about in stories. I had changed because of Tarbian. I had learned many things it would have been easier to live without. But sitting beside the fire, bending over the lute, I felt the hard, unpleasant parts of myself that I had gained in Tarbian crack. Like a clay mold around a now cool piece of iron, they fell away, leaving something clean and hard behind. I sounded the strings, one at a time. When I hit the third, it was ever so slightly off, and I gave one of the tuning pegs a minute adjustment without thinking.
Here now, don't go touching those.
Jazin tried to sound casual.
You'll turn it from true.
But I didn't really hear him. The singer and all the rest couldn't have been farther away from me if they had been at the bottom of the Sentha Sea. I touched the last string and tuned it too, ever so slightly. I made a simple chord and strummed it. It rang soft and true. I moved a finger, and the chord went minor in a way that always sounded to me as if the lute were saying sad. I moved my hands again, and the lute made two chords whispering against each other. Then, without realizing what I was doing, I began to play. The strings felt strange against my fingers, like reunited friends who have forgotten what they have in common. I played soft and slow, sending notes no farther than the circle of our firelight. Fingers and strings made a careful conversation, as if their dance described the lines of an infatuation. Then I felt something inside me break, and music began to pour out into the quiet. My fingers danced, intricate and quick, they spun something gossamer and tremulous into the circle of light our fire had made. The music moved like a spider web, stirred by a gentle breath. It changed like a leaf twisting as it falls to the ground, and it felt like 3 years' waterside in Tarbian, with a hollowness inside you and hands that ached from the bitter cold. I don't know how long I played. It could have been 10 minutes or an hour. But my hands weren't used to the strain. They slipped and the music fell to pieces like a dream on waking. I looked up to see everyone perfectly motionless, their faces ranging from shock to amazement. Then, as if my gaze had broken some spell, everyone stirred. Rowant shifted in his seat. The two mercenaries turned and raised eyebrows at each other. Derek looked at me as if he had never seen me before. Rita remained frozen, her hand held in front of her mouth. Denna lowered her face into her hands and began to cry in quiet, hopeless sobs. Jazin simply stood. His face was stricken and bloodless, as if he'd been stabbed. I held out the lute, not knowing whether to thank him or apologize. He took it numbly. After a moment, unable to think of anything to say, I left them sitting by the fire and walked toward the wagons. And that is how Kvothe spent his last night before he came to the university, with his cloak as both his blanket and his bed. As he lay down, behind him was a circle of fire, and before him lay shadow like a mantle gathered. His eyes were open, that much is certain. But who among us can say they know what he was seeing? Look behind him, instead, to the circle of light that the fire has made, and leave Kvothe to himself for now. Everyone deserves a moment or two alone when they desire it. And if by chance there were tears, let us forgive him. He was just a child, after all, and had yet to learn what sorrow really was.